Ms. Carl, you may proceed. You've got 15 minutes. Would you like any time for rebuttal?
If I could have 3 minutes, please, Your Honor.
3 minutes for rebuttal. Okay.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kimberly Carley. I'm representing Joshua Mosley here today. Mr. Mosley's case is really about speculation parading as reasonable inferences. The only way the evidence in this case would allow for Mr. Mosley's conviction of the four felonies is under the application of recent possession of stolen property, raising the inference that he is then both the thief and also the burglar of that property.
Well, recent possession plus proximity plus being seen by, in what seems like one of the most unlucky coincidences of the gentleman's life, an off-duty police officer going home.
And, Your Honor, I think we only get to those other factors if the Commonwealth can establish possession in the first instance.
But you concede that if we were to find that the circumstantial evidence was sufficient to support possession, not saying that it was, but if we find that, then the evidence is sufficient.
Absolutely. I think the law, even though, you know, I disagree with it, is very clear that that is sufficient under the circumstances if there is possession. But we only get to any of these other things if the Commonwealth first can establish possession. I believe the Commonwealth would have took issue with that position in its brief, making the argument, but there's the presence of the items in the vehicle, along with the presence of the documents, and then the presence of Mr. Mosley outside of one of the crime scenes, and then the presence, I guess, of these gloves that he was wearing, that all of those things together. And our position would be that the presence of the items and of the stolen goods in the vehicle with the presence of his items, again, is only relevant, is only legally significant if that amounts to possession. And I would cite to the case of Best v. Commonwealth, a Supreme Court case, for that proposition, that it's only possession that even gets us into this initial inquiry. And there's a quote in there that says, the presumption arises only when the accused has been shown to be in exclusive possession of recently stolen property, regardless of how much other incriminating evidence the Commonwealth has marshaled.
But counsel, if you don't get the inference for recent possession, you can still prove the case if you're the Commonwealth.
You can, and there's a footnote in Best that says the larceny conviction could be upheld when other evidence was independently sufficient. So if the other evidence is independently sufficient, then you don't need to rely upon that presumption.
Talk to us about why the other evidence is not sufficient.
Yes, Your Honor, what we have, the other evidence, putting aside everything related to the car, we have that Mr. Mosley is seen in proximity to a crime scene on the day of the crime. We don't know the exact time. We have a window of when that crime would have been perpetrated, but we don't know the exact time. He was seen within that window, but it was a window of roughly seven hours or so. So it is a very extensive window, and it is a full 2 weeks before the property is even located in this other vehicle. The presence of him being essentially arrested on another day on suspicion of a crime that was never prosecuted, I would submit, has no legal significance in this case. The fact that he had gloves on him, which was consistent with his explanation of being workout gloves.
But
and
counsel,
also
the trier of fact could have disbelieved that explanation as
they could, and Your Honor, and even if they did, with those two or possibly even three things being enough, what we have there, all we're raising is suspicion. So we don't have anything more than a suspicion of guilt, and it's only when we start talking about is he actually in possession of that stolen property that maybe those other things have some application. But just proximity to a crime scene and then a later arrest for something completely unrelated, and the fact that, you know, he was 2 weeks later that he was arrested with gloves, that's a suspicion and nothing more than that.
This was death by a thousand cuts.
I think it's a little bit less than 1,000 in this case, though, Your Honor. And going again, I think the controlling issue is, you know, were the items of stolen property in his possession? Well, quite simply, they're not. There are a number of cases, and primarily they deal with the drug context, but the issues of possession and the possession of drugs is exactly the same as what we're dealing with here. The Commonwealth would have to show that he had dominion and control over the property at the time that it was found, and that he also had actual knowledge of it and at the place where it was found. So we have a car that is not owned by him. that is found in an open space, in a parking lot, not a closed garage or a driveway.
Do you dispute the fact that there's evidence in the record that he used that car?
There is evidence that he used that car at some unknown point in time, and that is the best that the Commonwealth
on a regular basis.
On a regular basis, at an unknown point in time, the only temporal connection that the Commonwealth has between his use of the car and the timing of the burglaries and the finding of the property would be that one dated document, which was the Dominion Power Bill, which was dated some 3 months prior to the offenses. So if we assume from this that he regularly used the car in March of 2013, That was prior to the time when the burglaries happened in the property.
Does the evidence support an inference that it is, in fact, his car? Not necessarily that he knows everything that's in it or that he has exclusive control and possession of it as opposed to somebody else. But would you concede that the evidence gives rise to a reasonable inference that it's his car?
No, Your Honor, I would not concede that. It was registered to another person. It was not in his name. And the only thing I think the evidence gives rise to, again, is that he used that car at some point, possibly as late as March of 2013. And anything beyond that, I think, is speculation.
Explain the your analysis of how the Nelson opinion applies here.
Yes, Your Honor. Real quick. In Nelson, it was a case where the vehicle itself was the stolen property that was at issue, and it was the, in that case, Mr. Nelson's fingerprints was the primary piece of evidence, the only piece of evidence in that case against Mr. Nelson. And the court in that case essentially said that all the fingerprints show is that he was present in the vehicle. And they also make the finding that he was present in the vehicle subsequent to it being stolen. But his presence in the vehicle does not establish dominion and control over the vehicle. So even if he had been present after it was stolen, he was not found to be essentially have possession. Presence is not possession because he didn't have dominion and control, or the evidence was insufficient on that point. So they also then, I think, moved past that. And there was another fact in Nelson that we don't have here, where he actually denied being in the vehicle or having there be any reason for his fingerprints in the vehicle. And the court passed over that, essentially, and said, look, that's suspicious. That is incriminating. He lied, and the court can find that he lied about that. But that still doesn't kind of push it over the edge to say that his presence in the vehicle is enough for us to say that he had guilty knowledge and was in possession. And so, and that's, I think, would have been even a stronger case in Nelson than what the Commonwealth has here, because while we have some of Mr. Mosley's personal effects essentially are equated in this instance with the fingerprints, those things are on the same page.
His ID card?
I'm sorry?
His ID card?
His ID card, a library card, and then a power bill were the three things that the Commonwealth introduced. So while those things...
This was in the console car.
It was in the center console, yes. The ID card and the library card were in the center console. The power bill was in the glove compartment. But again, in Nelson, the court basically said, even though there's other incriminating evidence, this presence of these fingerprints still isn't enough to establish possession. And I think in with Mr. Mosley, we don't even have any incriminating statements or the rejection of those things. We don't even have that in with Mr. Mosley. So I think Nelson would have been stronger towards conviction, but the court still said it was not sufficient. And it's the same with the case of Burchett, which is what I really think controls the decision in this court. In Burchett, we've got a case where there's all kinds of personal documents or personal items of Mr. Burchett in his vehicle. The drugs are located throughout the vehicle, not just in one location. And the vehicle is in his driveway at his home, and he had walked past it. All of those things were established, and the drugs were in plain view, and he had walked past the vehicle. And in that case, the court still said no, because we don't have any evidence that he had dominion and control over the vehicle at the time the drugs were in it. And that's exactly what we have for Mr. Mosley. There was stolen property in the vehicle on June 17th. There is no information in the record.
A vehicle that he used on a regular basis.
At some point prior, yes,
Your
Honor.
He was seen at a crime scene or near a crime scene around the time of the offense, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Is the case different if the officer who happens to passing by as she's going home could have ID'd the vehicle?
I think it would be substantially different, yes. But she did not, and I think that is a noticeable defect in the Commonwealth's case. If it had been the same vehicle, pretty sure the Commonwealth would not have neglected to put that in the record. But I think that is a major difference. One of the points that the Commonwealth makes on brief is that there is some evidence in the record as to proximity between Mr. Mosley on the date he's arrested and where the vehicle is located. And I would submit that, no, that's another instance where we're essentially getting into the realm of speculation about relative distances. Because while the car was located, I believe it said, on Little Back River Road, and the officer who arrested Mr. Mosley said, I arrested him on East Little Back River Road, we can, I guess, infer that might be the same street, but there's nothing in the record to say how long is that street, how far apart, where on the street.
Well, you're not disputing that he has been in the car and that he has used the car.
That he had been in the car at some point. I think there's no evidence in the record to say that he had been in the car on June 17th, which I think is the most relevant day, or even on June 3rd, for that matter.
Except that he was seen in a car that met the description.
He was
in
never
the sense that it was a white vehicle.
At some point in time, but we can't say when, and we can't say whether.
But on the day of the burglary.
No, ma'am. I do not believe that is contained in the record that he was not ever seen in that vehicle on June 3rd or June 17th.
The person who puts him in the vehicle is the apartment manager.
Correct.
Who did not testify about June, couldn't remember what date.
Correct.
But the police officer saw him in the neighborhood in a vehicle driving out of the neighborhood.
On June 3rd.
Right.
In driving in a vehicle, not this vehicle.
And she didn't
say what vehicle it was.
But she didn't describe it as a white vehicle?
She did not describe it, vehicle at all. She only said that she saw him, but made no mention whatsoever of what kind of vehicle. And again, she had said it was a white vehicle or a white Crown Victoria, we would be in a different place. But I think the fact that she didn't say those things is of utmost importance. And again, going back to when he was arrested on June 17th, we don't know that we can't say from this record where he was arrested and its proximity to the vehicle on June 17th. It's a little bit like saying, well, I arrested him on Granby Street. Well, where? Granby Street by the ocean? Granby Street by the zoo? Granby Street by MacArthur Center? I mean, that's a big road. And we don't know that those are really the same
thing. Richmond landmark.
And that's out of my wheelhouse, Your Honor. See, I'm into my rebuttal time, so unless there are any questions, I'll have a seat. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Shandoval, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Chris Shandoval for the Commonwealth. I would submit that Mosley's argument on appeal is premised upon two primary assumptions, and I would submit that both of those assumptions are incorrect. The first assumption seems to be that the permissible inference from exclusive possession of recently stolen property was the only way that the Commonwealth could have proven its case against Mr. Mosley. And of course, we know that the law has never held that inference is the only way to prove a case of larceny, and that we had additional evidence here. The second primary assumption that's being made...
Do you concede that you need it as part of your constellation of proofs, that if we find that it wasn't sufficient?
I do not. And I'll explain why. I think that there's some confusion as to what exactly this inference is and what exactly it means. The second assumption that's being made is that unless...
Excuse me, Mr. Shandoval, can you just move that green thing? There you go.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Just want to make sure you're on record.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
I think the second assumption that's being made gets to that point, which is the assumption that unless that permissible inference applies, you cannot draw any inferences from the presence of the stolen property in the vehicle that Mr. Mosley was known to drive. And I think it stems from some confusion about what exactly that inference means and what exactly it entails and what exactly it does. If you trace that inference all the way back to Price versus Commonwealth, 1872, I think, Supreme Court of Virginia case, back in those days, the courts called it a presumption. And what the court said about it, both in Price and also in another equally ancient case, Tyler versus Commonwealth, 1917 Supreme Court case, is that what that presumption or inference does is where the Commonwealth can make that showing, then that inference alone, or that inference by itself, is sufficient to convict the defendant. So in other words, it's not just a reasonable inference that kind of adds to the scale of the defendant's guilt, but it's an inference that by itself establishes guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. We would concede that in this case we did not prove that Mr. Mosley had exclusive possession of the property at the time that it was discovered. However, that does not mean that, I think as opposing counsel seems to assume, it does not mean that the presence of stolen property in a vehicle that he was known to drive on a regular basis for months at a time, which was discovered with his windows down in a parking lot in a, on the same street, an apartment complex on the same street, of which Mr. Mosley was eventually arrested, that doesn't mean that you can't draw any inferences from the presence of that stolen property just because the inference beyond a reasonable doubt doesn't apply.
The record is silent as to how long that street is, isn't it?
Correct, Your Honor.
And I know you'll get the Richmond reference. Broad Street is an awful long street.
Yes, Your Honor, understandably. And I would submit that the question before this court, a court on appeal, is it a reasonable inference that a fact finder may have drawn? And the reason that we give inferences to trial courts to draw permissible, reasonable inferences is because trial courts, one of the reasons I would submit is that trial courts are more familiar with, you know, the community in which they're sitting and would perhaps have additional knowledge of how long that street might be. And I would submit that in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, East Little Back River Road and Little Back River Road, if he is arrested on that street and the apartment complex where the car is discovered is also on that street, that it's sufficient to infer that he's at least in the general vicinity. Now, had he walked a ways before he was arrested, perhaps, but I would submit that that is a reasonable inference the fact finder could find. And it's much more reasonable than the hypothesis of innocence, which I would submit is the only hypothesis that has been submitted to this court on appeal, that someone else who had, I guess, committed both of these burglaries, one 2 weeks prior.
Maybe the owner of the vehicle?
Maybe the owner of the vehicle. I don't think that was even proffered on appeal as a reasonable hypothesis of innocence. The only hypothesis on brief.
Let's skip the proffer. Is
correct.
It a reasonable one? I find Judge Decker very reasonable most of the time.
So your question is it a reasonable inference
given
that the
evidence,
owner...
Well, I mean, there was evidence in the record that he was not the titled owner of the vehicle.
Correct. I would submit that it is not reasonable to conclude that someone with $5,000 to $6,000 to $10,000 worth of stolen property in the center console in plain view would leave that vehicle with the windows rolled down and the keys inside for however long it takes for the vehicle to be towed away. I would submit that a fact finder...
Well, you'll have to concede that somebody did that.
Right, and I would submit that the person who did that was Mr. Mosley, and when he got arrested, he was prevented from going back to the vehicle and getting inside, rolling the windows up and driving away. And when you're looking at reasonable inferences and reasonable hypotheses of innocence that the fact finder could distinguish between, the question is not, is it possible that some other explanation might explain it? The question is, could a rational fact finder have rejected the exculpatory explanation and accepted the inculpatory explanation? Could a reasonable fact finder have come to that conclusion? I think this court's decision in...
Let me ask you this. So from the Commonwealth's perspective, evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, give us your laundry list of evidence that supports the conclusion you seek.
First of all, the fact that the police officer, again, the unluckiest day of his life, perhaps, the police officer drove by the house that was burglarized during the period of time in which it was burglarized, and Mr. Mosley was outside of that house in a car. And I would concede that the question was not asked, what did that car look like, what type of car was it? So that's unknown. We don't have on the record which car he was in. But I would submit that that does not explain his presence outside of a house that was burglarized during that time period. And Captain Canny's testimony that I know who is regularly on that street, it's a cul-de-sac, I know who visits whom, I know what cars people drive, he did not belong there. And there's been
he may not regularly go there. He's on a public street in Hampton, Virginia. I don't know of any rule that would prevent him or say that he doesn't belong there.
Well, we haven't. Sure, I would concede that. And we have not convicted him of being parked outside a house that was burglarized. The question is simply whether or not an inference can be drawn from his presence there. And again, it was a cul-de-sac. Captain Kenny knew which cars were regularly there, and he was parked against the curb beside the house that was burglarized during the window of time which it was burglarized. Now, if he had come in and explained to the trial court that actually the house across the street was a friend of his and he was just visiting them, that might be a reasonable hypothesis of innocence that would work in his favor. There's been no attempt to explain why he was outside that house during that time. The only argument has been that, well, maybe he was in a different car. But even assuming he was in a different car and the stolen property eventually ends up in this other car, a car that he was known to drive on a regular basis, that still supports an inference from his presence outside of that home during that time that he committed the burglary inside the home at that time. So on top of his presence there on that date, you also have his presence in the general vicinity, as I've argued, of the car where the car was discovered. You've got the fact that it was a car that he drove on a regular basis for several months at a time based on the testimony of the apartment manager.
But if I recall, she couldn't tie down a time window. The only time window the only piece of evidence suggesting a time window at all regarding him and that car is the March power bill. Electric bill.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I'll add just one piece of information to that. The March power bill is addressed to him, and it's addressed to him at a Pembroke apartment complex address. And she testified she was the manager of the Pembroke apartment complex on Pembroke Avenue. So from her testimony and the statement, you can conclude that for 3 or 4 months, at least leading up to March, he was driving that car on a regular basis. So it does leave open the question whether he continued to drive it after that 3 or 4 month period that she testified about. But when you combine it with the fact that he was arrested on the same street, at least, of the apartment complex where the car was discovered, I would submit that you could draw an inference.
The evidence of the titled owner of the vehicle, I know it was somebody other than him. Was there any evidence as to when that title had been transferred to that person?
Not that I know of, Your Honor.
And let me ask you this. If you're not relying on the exclusive possession, which you're not, and you're relying on circumstantial evidence, could the defendant have jointly possessed it with the owner of the vehicle and still be guilty of the offense?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. I think that given the fact that he was seen outside the home of one of the homes that was burglarized, that he could still be convicted for both burglaries. Counsel even conceded on the record, first of all, explicitly conceded that it's fair to assume the same person who committed the burglary committed the larceny in each case. And then also was asked by the trial court, would you also concede that the same person who committed the first burglary committed the second burglary, given, of course, that all the stolen property was found together? And counsel didn't concede the point, but at least conceded that that was an inference that could be drawn. So I would submit that given that concession, that's an inference that can be drawn. The same person committed both burglaries. You cannot turn around on appeal and then say, well, no rational fact finder could have possibly come to the conclusion that the same person committed both, because that has already been conceded as an inference that can be drawn. Finally, I'll also add the gloves in his pocket. He's given what he hopes the trial court would have accepted as an innocent explanation for those gloves. Of course, the trial court was not required to believe that explanation.
But counsel, unfortunately for the Commonwealth, there was no evidence or testimony regarding the significance of the gloves.
In terms of whether or not fingerprints were taken
from
the homes, or what's the
question? What relevance do gloves in a pocket have? I mean, there's nothing about it being burglarious tools or anything
right.
like that.
I would submit that gloves, it's known that while gloves do have innocent purposes, it's also known that burglars will also often use gloves to avoid leaving fingerprints. And throughout the case law, in Virginia's case law even, gloves have been discussed as a fact that can be considered in drawing an inference of whether or not this person committed the burglary.
Now, what time of year was it that he had the gloves?
This was June. And it was not a particularly cold day in June either. He was wearing athletic shorts, and the testimony about the gloves was that these were the type of heavy knit gloves that a grocery store owner might use in moving frozen foods around. So I would submit that based on that testimony, the trier of fact was certainly entitled to conclude these were not workout gloves that you might wear as you're in the gym pumping iron. These are the type of heavy knit gloves that a grocery store owner might use, or that someone who's burglarizing homes might use to avoid leaving fingerprints. And while it doesn't give as strong of an inference as if he'd had a crowbar in his pocket, perhaps,
an officer had testified about the relevance of gloves.
Right, that these are the gloves that sell on the black market when burglars are looking to buy gloves to break into homes. Correct. If we could possibly have that type of testimony. But I would still submit that the reasonable inference can be drawn. And yes, we could not have convicted him if we had found him in the area and he had gloves on him. But we found him in the area, he had gloves on him, and they were a certain type of gloves. He'd been seen outside one of the homes. This car that he was known to drive had all the stolen property in the center console intermingled with his identifying documents. And so the trier of fact made that factual finding that his library card and his identification card were intermingled with the stolen property in the center console, and that led him to reject Mr. Mosley's contention that, well, perhaps someone else placed the property here on top of my identifying documents. That is also a reasonable conclusion, I would submit.
The Odie defense.
What?
Other dude did it.
Correct. And in this case, unfortunately for Mr. Mosley, there was never any other dude identified. Other than a name on a registration piece of paper in the glove compartment, and we know nothing else about that individual.
Counsel,
all signs point to Mr. Mosley.
Counsel, what is the relevance of the Nelson case, and can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The Nelson case is one of many cases that demonstrates what required showing is necessary in order for a defendant to be entitled to an inference beyond a reasonable doubt that he is the thief. And so if you fall short of that, I would submit that evidence that you were relying upon is still some evidence. It's just not enough by itself to prove guilt. But then you look to additional evidence that might be in the record. And Nelson demonstrates that is exactly the procedure that courts have followed. In that case in particular, there were fingerprints of the defendant in the vehicle. And the court said, well, based on the fingerprints alone, we know that he was in the car at some time. But that's not going to be enough to give him the permissible inference beyond a reasonable doubt that he's guilty.
So you're saying Nelson is not relevant for a circumstantial evidence case?
Well, I think
you don't use the inference.
Correct, but it's got some relevance because the court actually does proceed to engage in the type of analysis that we're asking the court to engage in here, which is to ask, okay, well, assuming and concluding that he hasn't established enough exclusive possession to get the inference beyond a reasonable doubt, we still have to look at all the evidence together to decide whether or not the Commonwealth establishes guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, taking it all together. And when the court did that in Nelson, the court considered the fact that based on his fingerprints, he had been inside that vehicle sometime after it had been stolen. So even though the fingerprints by themselves were not enough to get the inference beyond a reasonable doubt, it was still some evidence to be considered in the totality of the circumstances to determine whether or not he was guilty. In this case, we're asking the court to do the same thing. Even though we didn't prove that he was in exclusive possession of the stolen property at the time that it was found, that is still some evidence to be considered in totality with all the other evidence that exists in this case, specifically his presence outside the home at the time that it was being burglarized. And the question is, together, could a reasonable fact finder conclude, reject his supposed hypotheses of innocence, and conclude that he was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt? And we would submit that the evidence was sufficient considered in its totality. Unless there are any questions, other questions from the court.
Let me just ask you another follow-up from Nelson. In Nelson, the fingerprints were found on the actual item that was stolen.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the court said that's not enough.
Correct, Your Honor.
Your position is that while there are no fingerprints in your case and the stolen items are in a vehicle that's used by the appellant on a regular basis, mm-hmm. if you add all the other evidence up, it equals sufficient.
Correct, Your Honor. And I also think that the stolen property, the context of the stolen property being in the vehicle is more persuasive and more probative than a couple fingerprints in the vehicle, given the fact that the stolen property, one, was intermingled with his identification document. So it wasn't just a couple fingerprints, you know, up on the roof of the car somewhere. They were intermingled together. And then secondly, the fact that a reasonable fact finder could conclude, as the court's case law has repeatedly held, that people are not likely to abandon valuable contraband. So The hypothesis of innocence is someone in the community walked by and decided, hey, here's a car with its windows down and the keys in. This looks like a good place to hide my stolen property, and then left. And then the car eventually was towed. I would submit that is not a reasonable hypothesis of innocence.
Well, but to go to Judge Felton's Odie defense, that whoever the thief was left the car, well, did abandon the property in that exact manner. We know that for a fact.
Right.
In fact, the Commonwealth's theory is that the thief abandoned the property exactly in that manner.
The Commonwealth's theory is that the thief abandoned the property momentarily while he went to burglarize another home with hopes of coming right back and then driving off. He was prevented from doing that by the police who arrested him. But if some other individual had left the property there and abandoned it and hoped to have come back to retrieve it, you would think that he would at some point come back and retrieve it before the car could be towed. Unless there are any further questions, I would ask the court to affirm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Carl, you have a few minutes for rebuttal.
Thanks. The first point I'd like to make, going kind of to that, the Commonwealth's theory about Mr. Mosley was arrested before he could come back to the car. The other detail that the record reveals is that when the tow truck driver showed up at 10:30 that night, police were on scene. We don't know how long the police were on scene, but I think that kind of cuts against the Commonwealth's point there, that there could be another reason why no one came back to recover this property. If the police had been on scene for some period of time, then whoever did it, not Mr. Mosley, could have been deterred from coming back.
But counsel, at this juncture, you have a big hurdle in the sense that everything is viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, and wherein there are several possible inferences, we have to presume that the trier of fact chose the one that supports the Commonwealth.
That a fair point, Your Honor. But I think in conclusion of all of this, it really also comes back to that car and tying the vehicle to Mr. Mosley, but more specifically tying the property inside the vehicle to Mr. Mosley. And with the Commonwealth's concession that he is not in possession of that or exclusive possession of that, our position is that ends the court's analysis, not because the court can't consider other evidence, but because the other evidence in this case plainly is not sufficient. The only other evidence, taking away the legal significance of that car and the information contained therein, the other evidence is his presence or proximity to a crime scene and his possession of these gloves. And those two things are simply not sufficient. And when the inference doesn't apply, Mr. Mosley has no obligation to explain anything to the trial court. And so I, under the totality of all of these circumstances, even viewed in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth, the record is plainly insufficient to have found him guilty of these charges. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. We'll come down and